my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Well, I hit the rowdy road, many kinds I met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, a second stick the time out. There's so much left to know when I'm on the road to find out.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. Unspun brings you information you need to deal with the important issues of our time. We're streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the Listen button. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners, and our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. You can also send me an email at unspun@kkrn.org. Well, co-hosting with me today is Dr. Doug Craig. Dr. Craig is a psychologist here in Reading. He has two outstanding blogs, Free Therapy on anewscafe.com and Climate of Change on the Reading Record Searchlight's website at reading.com. Dr. Doug Craig, thanks for being on with me today.
Always good to be with you, Doug.
It's good to have you in the studio. Well, we have two interesting guests on the phone this morning, Peter Seidel and Gary Gardner. They have collaborated on a new book, There's Still Time. Peter has had a varied and diverse career as a farmhand, factory worker, Alaska salmon fisherman, carpenter, professor, architect, urban planner, and now an author. He has written several books, including Invisible Walls, Why We Ignore the Damage We Inflict on the Planet, and Global Survival, The Challenge and Its Implications for Thinking and Acting. You can go to PeterSeidelBooks.com for more about his publications. Gary Gardner is a senior fellow at the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. Gary Gardner is a director of publications at the World Watch Institute. He has written on a broad range of sustainability issues, from cropland loss and water scarcity to malnutrition and bicycle use. He is the author of the 2006 book, Inspiring Progress, Religion's Contributions to Sustainable Development. Before joining World Watch in 1994, Gary was a project manager of the Soviet Non-Proliferation Project, a research and training program run by the Monterey Institute of International Studies in California. Peter Seidel and Gary Gardner, welcome to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. Let me get your mic set. Good to have you on the air. I had your mics kind of down there for a second, so we kind of missed your response. But thank you for being on with us. I was thinking your book is a two-part book. Part one is a call to action, written by Peter, and part two, Our Planet Today, written by Gary. And they complement each other pretty well, I thought. But I want this to be kind of a free-flowing conversation, invite both of you and also my co-host, Dr. Craig, to kind of add to the conversation the best way we can, because really an hour is a short period of time to talk about such a huge subject. So when we respond or, answer one of these questions or want to respond to each other, maybe we make our responses fairly short and our answers fairly short, keep them under 5 minutes. I know that's going to be tough, make you kind of cook it all down for us and for our listeners. So let's just start with Peter, since your part is talking mostly about the failures of let me think about this. Maybe we should start with Gary. Because he's dealing with the current state of our world. In fact, that's one of the publications that he works on there at World Watch. Gary, maybe you can give our listeners a brief understanding of where we are. What is the state of our world?
Well, thank you so much, Doug, and it's great to be with you this morning. You know, one of the things that I find so interesting about this era in which we live is that it is unique in the sense that we are presented with challenges that human beings have never had to face ever in our history. So we're looking at challenges like water scarcity and food shortages and climate change and toxics that are poisoning our environment. And deforestation and fisheries loss, and the list goes on and on and on. And one of the problems is that we have built our economies in such a energy-intensive way, and that energy generally comes from fossil fuels, that it is quite a challenge for us to figure out how to get off of the track that we're on and onto a track that uses renewable resources, that circulates all of our materials so that we are a circular economy, so that we have no waste. It really is quite the challenge that we have in front of us. And as I say, we've never faced anything like this as human beings. And I think, as Peter will very clearly tell us, we're very slow at responding to the challenge.
That was the part about the book that, even though the title is "There Is Still Time," when I read the book, I was kind of figuring out how we're going to make use of the little time we have left, and the part of that, and I'm going to go to Peter now, because his part of the book really talks about the many failures, both as individuals and institutions, governments, at every level, the failure to handle these large problems. Climate change, of course, is probably the biggest problem ever, as you pointed out. And so I'm going to ask Peter, what are the three biggest roadblocks to taking meaningful action on climate change to preserve our world?
Well, I'll give you one. That's us. If you look behind all the problems that Gary is talking about, what is the cause of them all? Us. And that is it. And it's you know, we there is all this information. You know, just example, there is all this information out there about what we're doing to the planet. There's a lot of it. You know, like, every day seems the same to us, but it's not. Every day there are 228,000 more people on the planet. Since I've been born, the population of the planet's grown more than 3.5 times. And going through a lot of other things, there's these same types of problems. And then on the other hand, is that we're not doing enough about it. You know, the information is out there, and we know what we can do. Yet, we only make feeble efforts to try to resolve these problems. You know, looking at our knowledge on climate change, how little we have done since, you know, our efforts trying to do it. And we know about climate change, actually. Alexander von Humboldt talked about the effect of humanity on changing the planet. But in, I think it was 1886, a Swedish chemist came up to the conclusion that we are increasing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and that this could cause the planet to warm. And just several years later, in New York, developed by Chamberlain in America, came to the same conclusion without knowing of the Swedish one. And this has been going on and on and on, and we have not been dealing with, you know, this information was out there. In fact, under President Johnson, they had a report to the president on the environment, 22 pages of something like 240 pages, 22 pages or so, were taken up with climate change during Johnson's time, and telling, you know, how dangerous it was. Well, you know, it goes on and on and on, and here we are now, and a lot of people are saying that this thing in Paris is probably not going to be effective.
Mm.
And we have a whole series of politicians in this country who refuse to accept that idea that humanity has anything to do with it.
Hi, this is Doug Craig. Appreciate being on the show today, and thank you, gentlemen, for your contribution. I'm a psychologist in my day job, and I'm always puzzled by, as you say, the human mind, the brain, what helps us solve our problems and what prevents us from doing so. And on the way into the studio this morning, I noticed there was a new business being built to another oil change business, and it just reminded me how far we haven't come in terms of grappling with this issue with transitioning from fossil fuels to renewables. And so the profound implication or challenge, I suppose, is how do we deal with the human brain and its denial when we have a media system, global media system, that is tied up with the old fossil fuel economy. We're speaking truth. The scientists are speaking with one voice on this issue, but there's this disconnect between that horrible reality. It's as if we're all walking around with terminal cancer and pretending we don't have this disease. So it does seem like it's a psychological problem. How do we impact the denial, not just that climate change is real, but the urgency of it? Like you say, it is, we have time, but that window is closing. What must we do as individuals to wake ourselves up and one another?
Dr. Craig, I think that's at the heart of the matter. That's a very key point you're raising. And both you and Peter would know better than I whether this is true, but what I always read is that we humans have evolved such that we take very immediate threats very seriously. So if a saber-toothed tiger is hunting us down, we react to that very quickly. But slowly emerging threats are ones that we're much slower to react to, and that's exactly what we face now. We face threats that are unfolding over decades, if not longer, and that is hard. It's difficult to get our attention when we're facing those kinds of threats. On the other hand, there are things that motivate us that I think we need to think about. And one that I always hear mentioned is, we care very much about our children. And if we become convinced that our children's future is in peril, that they will not have the same kinds of opportunities that we have had growing up, then I think that's one way that we can get motivated to begin to take the problem seriously.
Yeah, Peter, of course, you enumerated so many mankind's shortcomings: our violent nature, lack of imagination, confirmation bias, corrupt institutions, corporate control of the mainstream media. So where do you weigh in on that question? How do we get people moving in the direction that will help us preserve our planet?
Well, that of course, is the big problem, is how to get people. There are two chapters at the end of part one. First chapter is sort of globally what we should do, what society should do, what humankind should do. And we're doing some of those things, but far weaker than what's needed. We're not working up to the challenge. And there's a part, and we've got to. Somehow this has got to switch, that the mass of humanity has going to be going up to this challenge, which we did that in World War II after Pearl Harbor. Boy, did we go to work. But it took Pearl Harbor to do that. And I'm not looking forward to an environmental Pearl Harbor. By that time it'll be too late to save much at all. And we'd hardly know how to deal with that in this world with all these split nations and all of that. But there are a group of people who we can rely on to do better, and I think they will. And that is, today, there are people, very committed environmentalists out there, who really are doing what they can to get things moving and get things started. And I think one of our hopes is that this group can find other new ways on top of what they're already doing, that they can increase their power, because they will do it, because they want to see something happen, and they're willing to commit themselves. And that's what Chapter 7 is about. And interesting, I call for suggestions on that, because as I wrote the book, in fact, I have just printed up a bunch of new copies that has one more suggestion than the last one. And I have a website, and on the website it calls for ideas. And so I hope that people who will come up with such ideas will put them on the website, because we've got to collect these ideas and put them out there for people who will and want to do better.
Let me break in here. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Co-hosting today is Dr. Doug Craig, and on the phone are Peter Sardell and Gary Gardner, co-authors of There Is Still Time. We're discussing climate change, the state of our world, and how to fix it. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 337-1885. Well, we had Dr. Craig and I participated on a climate change forum not too long ago, a few weeks ago, and my approach was to scare the hell out of them. I thought, you know, this is scary stuff, and so that was my approach. Others, you know, had like Dr. Craig. Of course, he had a much more scientific basis and a little more rational than mine. but my approach was what? Of course, we should be afraid. I mean, if it's not imminent, yeah, that's one thing. But here we have built civilizations on, you would think, more logical and scientific bases than what we see being applied to this problem. And one of the things that I brought up, because I think it is more imminent than most of us believe, but there's these tipping points, and part of the premise of your book is that as long as we haven't reached those tipping points, we're going to be okay. But the question then becomes, how close are we to those tipping points, and what are they?
Well, it's very clear that we've already passed some of the tipping points. We're past the point where our emissions of greenhouse gases, you know, carbon from our automobiles and our electricity use, or methane from landfills and other sources, where those are emitted at a rate that the planet cannot absorb, and that's why our climate is changing. So in that sense, we've passed tipping points. We've passed tipping points in the sense that species are going extinct. We're living in the first, the sixth mass extinction in the history of the world, the first one ever caused by humans. So down the line, on topic after topic, we are already past some tipping points, and on those issues, things will only get worse, and our capacity to deal with the problems that those tipping points cause will only get worse, will be compromised. So in that sense, we're not talking about a problem that's awaiting us in the future. We're talking about a problem that is unfolding right now. I think all of us would agree that we've seen tremendous changes in our climate. And, of course, we're always quick to say that no single climate event can be, a weather event can be attributed to climate change. And yet, the changes that we've seen over the last 10 years are very consistent with what scientists tell us to expect in a world of a changed climate. We're very familiar with that here in California with our drought. So I think it's a mistake to sort of frame this as though problems are down the line. They are here. They are here, and they're unfolding. We're in the early stages of many of them, but they're unfolding, and we need to act sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it seems that we have an urgent and imminent disaster unfolding right before us, and yet we turn our TVs on and everything gets framed to accommodate maybe a different storyline that maybe those in power would prefer that we focus on. You know, for example, the Syrian refugees flowing into Europe, and some of which are coming this way, are in part refugees because of climate change. In Syria, there was a very serious drought for many years, and that was part of the problem that led many farmers to abandon. There was no longer viable to be farmers or to be ranchers, and many of them flooded into the cities. Young people with no prospects for employment, and so I just would like you to comment on that too. I think Bernie Sanders has made that point that, and others are making the point that this. Confluence of various factors of terrorism and climate change and national security threats and climate refugees. I mean, it's all exploding across the planet, and yet we don't have a media system that can articulate actually what connect the dots for us.
Yeah, I think that is correct, and I'm reminded of the 1990s when there was a terrible genocide in Rwanda, when two ethnic groups were at each other's throats, literally, and killing many, many, many people. And World Watch at the time did some analysis and found that the pressure on the land because of population growth in that country was large, that it was exacerbating any ethnic tensions that existed between the various groups there, and that it made... It contributed, the population growth leading to lack of agricultural land for farmers, you know, very small plots that were inherited by sons in farming families, that it was that lack of land and that that population pressure that helped to exacerbate the ethnic tensions there. So I think you're absolutely right that when we look more deeply at many of the problems in the world today, we might find an environmental or population influence on those issues.
Yeah, Peter, did you have something to add there?
Well, just a little bit. Yes. Well, one sees all of this terrible things happening right now and how we're trying to deal with it, but looking at the problems that Gary was talking about, the strain on all of these places and all of us is going to get worse. And so, since these kinds of things were driving much of this unrest that's going on today, as everything gets worse, what is going to happen politically and socially around the world?
Well, I just want to make a comment about what's happening in Paris. I think this is exemplary of our inability to react to things logically. According to some of the diagrams and charts that Gary provided in the book, There's Still Time, he points out the fact that much of the Middle East is beginning to become rapidly inhabitable. And then you look at the reaction of the people in Paris to a pretty logical result of our aggression, corporate, and Gary talks about the economies, too, of the world. Well, we've become a very exploitative capitalist economy and most of the Western world, and yet we're creating these situations that are untenable. We cannot win. We're wasting huge amounts of energy. I would dare to say that the Pentagon is the largest polluter and waster of energy on the planet, and also waste of precious funding for something that we could do better to fight climate change. So here we have this totally illogical, predictable thing going on, and what is our response is to not even look at the root causes. So if either one of you want to respond to that, I just had to get that off my chest. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I would just say I think it's a very interesting point, and I think one of the interesting pieces about the nature of the problems that we're facing is that the Earth has generously given us wiggle room, I think, to work with, to help us get through tough times. So that, for example, we have a drought, but we have aquifers. We have groundwater that we can pump in case of a drought so that we're not actually out of water. And yet we take that extra padding that natural systems have, and we turn them to current consumption. It would be like using your retirement savings to, pay the electricity bill and your mortgage and your car payment and your food. That's not what your retirement savings is meant to be for. And yet that's how we operate in the world today. And so we find what we think are clever ways of getting through a problem. But that problem, if it's not actually dealt with and solved, just becomes an ongoing problem, and our clever solutions are not viable over the long term. You mentioned the Middle East. Excuse me. One thing that's very interesting about the Middle East is they're very short of water, and water agriculture is the number one water user in most countries. So you need a lot of water to grow food, a lot. And these countries don't have they have less and less water per person because of their population growth. So the question is, well, how do they continue to feed themselves? If you're right, Gary Gardner, about what you're saying here, why don't we see just mass uprising, throughout the Middle East? Well, we are, in fact, beginning to see more social unrest there. But the deeper answer is that these countries are turning to international markets for their food. So that most of the countries in North Africa and the Middle East import a good share of their food. Many of them, over 50% of their grain comes from overseas. And that's fine as long as international markets can supply that amount of grain. But what happens when the United States, for example, which is one of those big suppliers, endures a drought as we have in California, which has lowered our agricultural production, at least the part that comes from normal sources of water. What happens when other nations start adopting the same strategy and say, oh, we're running short of water, we should import more food too? Not everybody can do that. And my point here is that we're just kicking the can down the road and not really solving the water scarcity problem in many countries. But the tab will come, the bill will come due down the line, and unless we start dealing with those issues now, it's not going to be a pretty picture down the line.
The U.S. Geological Survey, I saw a graph there, and if we believe that we're exempt, we are guilty here in California of doing exactly the same thing that you describe. We've drained watersheds in all over Southern California to feed the megalopolis monster that's down there. We hear the Central Valley. I saw this chart from the USGS that showed that didn't matter over the last, I think it was 20 or 40 years, didn't matter how much rainfall we had. It didn't matter if we were in a drought or not. We are constantly lowering the water table throughout the Central Valley, which means we are depleting, as you say, our retirement package, our reserve. We have no reserve. And we're using up the reserve that we have more rapidly than we should. And so we are a ticking time bomb right here in the middle of the United States. One of the greatest producers of produce is the California Central Valley. And we're going to go away maybe sooner than we think. A prolonged drought here will cripple this nation, and we think we're exempt, but we're not.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, Doug, and I would add to the picture that you've painted, the fact that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the body of scientists at the United Nations level that studies climate change around the world, says that the Sierra Nevada will experience probably 40% reduction, a minimum of 40% reduction in snowpack in the coming decades. And that's our summer water, as you know, for at least and I say our because I'm in California, south of where you are. And that's, you know, that's what we depend on to get us through the summer and into the fall. And so that source of water that is a source for much of our agriculture will not be available to us in the future. It makes the picture all the more complicated and more challenging.
Let me remind our let me come back to you in a second, Peter. I wanted to remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. We have a caller, but I want to let the other callers know if they want to call in. Our number is 337-1885. We have Peter Saddell and Gary Gardner on the phones, and I have Dr. Doug Craig in the studio with me. We're talking about climate change. I have a caller that's been waiting a long time, so I'm going to try to bring her up on the air, and we'll see what happens here. I got three phone lines going, so let's try this. Pamela, you're on the air.
Well, good morning to you all.
Well, good morning.
And you're all providing such wonderful information, so many things to talk about and think about. And, you know, in terms of the aquifers, I was just thinking that, you know, the little that we do have, the fracking contaminates that, and we don't seem to take action on that. But what I wanted to ask, and Dr. Craig brought this up as well as others, is changing the national story, you know, the narrative that most people seem to be hearing. And as I was listening to the news this morning, what I'd heard was because of what's happening in the Middle East and in Paris, gun sales are up. You know, that's in the U.S., people are going out and buying weapons because that's going to help them, you know, feel secure, as well as weapons manufacturers making tons of money. So, but this comes back to what you're all saying, is that how do we change the narrative? How do we get the information more out about climate change, about the water, about the drought, about the fires, you know, about climate change, rather than on, if I just buy a gun, I'm going to be safer?
Okay.
It's kind of crazy to me. So I'll hang up and take my answer on the air.
Thanks for the question, Pamela. Yeah, Peter.
Unfortunately, I could hardly hear that question.
Oh, probably because you were sharing a line. Basically, is how do we get the word out? I know you've talked about a lot of these options, and maybe that's a good chance for you to talk to the problem of how do we educate, how do we get people involved, how do we get the word out about climate change?
Well, that is a big question, and the thing is, all of this information is there, you know, it's there, and we're not looking at it. And one thing I think that too much, well, journalists by nature are more interested in political and current things, and they see things as packages instead of seeing the huge problem, you know, as a whole. And so one of the problems is through the media, we're not getting as much information, and it's not as often. In fact, if you look at statistics on reports on environmental things, they're way down there. We hear constantly about the economy. So people see that as very important. But because they're aware that there are environmental problems, but because it's mentioned so rarely, so somehow these things have got to become much more important. You know, every day, you know, there are tremendous changes in our planet. Like I mentioned, the population, about the erosions of soils and depletion of water. This should be on this is more important news than, you know, some bombing in some city, which can occupy the media for. Well, so this has a tremendous influence on the public as to what they think is important. So the media has needs to stress these long-term things and slow changes, which can be drastic. I mean, you know, the fact that there's 228,000 more people on the planet in a day is a major thing. And so the media has to play a big part in this. And also, I think in science teachers, we have to have better science education. you know, where people come away understanding what science is, and that science is not another agenda that some people have, that they're just promoting this idea against people who are calling for more economic growth. It's not it's fundamental. You know, it's there, and people have got to learn to understand that.
You know,
if I might just this is Gary. Often I think, certainly we at World Watch, we were founded on the notion that if we provide information, people will be amazed and shocked and will swing into action. And I think our understanding of psychology now is such that we understand that for some people, information motivates, and different kinds of information motivate differently. But for a lot of people, we need to be more about being storytellers, so that we're not just providing information, but we're also providing a storyline, because for whatever reason, humans really respond to stories. I mean, that's why we go to movies. That's why Hollywood is such a big success. That's why people read novels, is because they love a good storyline. And that's why the media, that's what the media is often looking for, is a good storyline. And I would just, challenge us in the environmental community to figure out how we can get our message out in a story form that really does motivate people. I mean, Peter gave a good example, I think, of World War II, where our country mobilized, and, you know, people were setting up victory gardens. There was scrap collections so that we were recycling more metal. There were a lot of wonderful things that were happening that showed how we could respond to an emergency. And that kind of storyline, I think, is really more the way that we need to be communicating with people, that this what sounds like a disaster, and really is a disaster if we don't do anything, all of these issues that we're talking about, a disaster unfolding, actually is an opportunity as well. And we need to learn to frame the issue as an opportunity, how we can make economies that provide for people all of their needs, that is fair to all people, but is able to do so on a much lighter energy and materials footprint. That would be a huge success story, and we humans are capable of doing that. But I think it would help if we framed it as a challenge and something that we can succeed in, rather than always focusing just on the disasters that are impending. So it's a challenge to myself more than anybody else.
Al Gore, in his movie An Inconvenient Truth back in 2007, made the point that too many people go from ignorance, denial, and then they just go immediately to despair. The in-between move, you know, once we're awakened, is to have that vision of what you're talking about, that believe in the story, kind of the storybook ending or fairy tale ending, but in a very positive sense that I deal with every day in my clinical practice, that when people come in with problems, I want them to leave the office optimistic, hopeful, encouraged, and determined to act. So when people tell me that, oh, well, we can't live on renewables, that just isn't possible, or they have this fantasy that we're just going to have desalination plants all over the place and just solve our water problem that way. I realize we have a long ways to go to help people understand that that the old way of doing things is not going to be the future. It just can't be, otherwise we'll be extinct. So how do we respond to people when they say that we can't possibly give up fossil fuels? It seems to me like an addict saying, you know, I can't possibly live without chocolate bars or alcohol or cigarettes or, you know, Twinkies. You know, I think there clearly is a future that's viable for ourselves and our children and future generations, but we have to kind of break through this mental frame that says, no, we can't change.
I agree 100%, Dr. Craig, and you know, one way that we can start to do that is look at the success stories. You know, look at the people who run their houses on 100% renewable energy. Look at the people who reduce their garbage to one bag per year. one garbage bag per year because they're recycling so much and they're not buying material that would be thrown out, you know, in the first place. Look at the cities that have set goals for 100% renewable energy. Look at the cities that have set goals for 100% reduction in waste to landfill. I mean, these sound like preposterous goals that could not possibly be achieved, but they are being achieved, often on small scale. And in those cases, the question is, how do we scale them up? This challenge is surmountable. It is possible for us to do what we need to do to live within the budget, the environmental budget that our planet gives us. But it's going to take ingenuity, and it may not all be done. It's very important to say it may not all be done through technology, that some of it will require lifestyle changes. I'm not sure if up there in Reading, if you have car sharing like Zipcar, that is an ingenious way to give people access to a private car without having everybody own a private car. And if we don't have everybody owning a private car, we save huge amounts in fuel and materials use every year. But what they've done with Zipcar is they found that people don't need a car all the time, that most cars spend most of their time parked. And that's a huge waste of resources. And so one way to get around that is to make cars available around the city to people as they need them. That kind of ingenuity is going to give us the kind of lifestyle that we need. That is a lifestyle that allows us to have opportunity without the resource demands that we've become accustomed to. It's that kind of ingenuity that we need to see multiplied across our economy.
Go ahead, Peter.
No, there's a whole other thing that could be done, and just isn't done. I got hired to design a new town outside of Cincinnati, and it was based on a model that I had made when I was teaching at the University of Michigan. And I did that because I saw, well, I had had a wonderful teacher when I was a graduate student who was on city planning. He came from Bauhaus in Germany, and he had some wonderful ideas. I was living in Ann Arbor and going into Detroit, I could see what was happening to Detroit. It was just eating up the countryside. It was terrible. It was terrible for people within the city to get from one part of the city during the rush hour. It could take well over an hour. And so I developed a whole system of building new communities which were based on a simple idea that a community is people communicating and working and intermingling with each other. If you start with a basic idea like that, and always get down to basics, then you come up with something quite different than what we do. And on my website, I have a section on new communities that shows basically what I'm talking about. And they, at the time, I figured it probably sound a bit strong, but I figured that we could get transportation down to less than about 5% spent on automobiles and trucks than what people are spending now, and as much energy used, as much driving. It would cut it down to, say, 5%. And this can be done, but we don't look. We just keep doing the same thing we do over and over, and we're driven by urges. You know, we think that big lots and, you know, far out is good. And the other day, I live pretty near the center of the city, and I had to go someplace, and I got caught in a line of autos, and I thought, my God, how can these people do this every day? It's insane. And you see all these autos belching up stuff into the air and all this paved highways that these people are using. And so by looking at things and seeing them in a different way, we could. Now, it's hard to undo a lot of what we've got. But I think there are ways that we could make what we've got work much better. And where we do have to provide for more people, we could do it in a far better way, which my model cities demonstrate. You can find that on my on my website, peterseidelbooks.com.
Let me remind our listeners one more time. You're listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Co-hosting today is Dr. Doug Craig. On the phone are Peter Seidel and Gary Gardner, co-authors of There Is Still Time. Excuse me. We're discussing climate change, the state of our world, and how to fix it. You can call in with your comments and your questions at 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Well, coming back to our discussion, we're talking about scale. And from what I can determine, the kind of scale we need is going to involve government at every level. And yet I made a little list this week alone of headlines about what's going on inside of our governments. And let me just read this real quickly and then just a response, whoever wants to respond. But the first one I had is two Senate bills were passed, which involved payola to Congress, to block the EPA's clean air provisions that Obama put in place. And the second one is the Paris demonstrations that were scheduled at the COP21 climate change meeting in Paris. They've been blocked by the French government. The third one I have here is King County Court Judge Hollis R. Hill found in favor of the children's right to a healthy environment. And the fourth one I have is GMO salmon approved by the FDA without labeling. And the last one, which is more encouraging, there was an article about 139 countries in the world can be 100% renewable in a very short period of time. So your responses to any of those or to the whole idea that somehow government doesn't seem to be getting it done on the scale we need?
Quick, they're not.
Your response, Gary? I know you talk a lot about economies.
Well, you know, it can be very discouraging, and I'm not terribly optimistic that we're going to see a very strong agreement come out of Paris in the next month. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that nothing is happening. And I think if we look at the state of California, for example, is regarded as a leader in trying to tackle climate issues. Many cities around the world are very serious about trying to make their cities more sustainable. And that's a good sign because cities are the locus of a lot of economic activity around the world. And so if we can solve the problems there, we're a good distance down the road to becoming a more sustainable society. Our book, The State of the World, which we produce at World Watch for 2016, will focus on sustainable cities. So there are many areas where there is a lot of encouraging work, and I would even say in some businesses that you find some more progressive, I guess, mentality where people really are taking seriously their responsibility to live more lightly on the planet. So there are definitely some encouraging signs. Not nearly enough that we can just rest on those laurels. Instead, we need to be building on those, multiplying those, making those much stronger across our economy. But as I started to say earlier when I was talking about car sharing, that I just think that we shouldn't underestimate the ingenuity of human beings. Another way that service has been provided to people without using nearly as much materials is what some copy companies like Xerox have done to try to make sure that people can still get the copies that they need, but with much less materials use. So it switched its business model many years ago from selling copiers to leasing them. And just think about it from the business perspective. If you're Xerox and you are leasing your copiers, that means they're going to come back to you, which means that you have a strong incentive to try to recycle them or reuse them, refurbish them, which means that you design them from the beginning to be refurbished. And so you're getting the same service to people, copy services, with a much lower materials footprint. And it's that kind of ingenuity, that and car sharing And I have to say also an ethic of sufficiency. You know, most of us have been raised in an economy where consumption really is, for many people, the reason that we live. It's what we get up in the morning to do, is to earn money to go and consume more. And I think we need a different model for understanding, you know, why we're here on this planet, what it is that we're meant to be doing. And once we begin to embrace all these things, the ingenuity in business, the activism at the government level, especially state and local areas, changes in our own personal, you know, consumption ethics, then we start to have the elements of a solution to the problem.
In your book, go ahead, Peter.
I would like to jump in because there's not much more time, and there's something very important. But before that, I'll quickly mention that part two, which Gary wrote, he wrote about a number of problems. And climate change is so much occupying people's minds, but all of these problems are very serious. And Lester Brown recently came out and said that he thinks the one that's going to hit us first and hardest is water. And I was thinking about that, and I think that he's probably right. Well, what I want to mention, what I do want to get in, is that when you look at us as people, we are creatures that have evolved to live sustainably on this planet as hunter-gatherers. We did for millennia. We kept on living sustainably. And that has changed. Because of what we are, we had the ability to greatly expand our niche on the planet and the impact it has on it. Actually, what's going on, if you look at the long time humanity has been on the planet, it's an instant or a fraction of an instant where the changes and the impact that we're having on the planet is exploding. And we're living in that right now. And the problem is that we have these minds of hunter-gatherers, and we cannot deal with the kind of environment that we have predicted. We both in living with each other and how we treat each other terribly, and there's a lot on that in the book. That's part of the problem, and then the other part is how we're treating the planet. You know, both these ways are terrible. And so we have got to get beyond that, and we have got to become more than what we are. We've really got to understand ourselves and got to understand our planet. And this is what most people don't understand. And there's one quote I stuck in the front of the book because it fits right in with this, from Edward O. Wilson. And he said, "We have created a Star Wars civilization with Stone Age emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology."
Well, that says a lot. I think Dr. Craig had something to add in here.
Yeah, I just am impressed with your book, gentlemen. And I know there's not much time, and I appreciate what you're saying, because I think in a nutshell, you've mentioned in your book that we need to see the world as a unified whole and interact with it as such holistically. And it just occurs to me that we are still treating the world like a video game and a competition where, there or a lottery economy, even, where there's these, you know, one winner for every, you know, million losers, so to speak. You mentioned something called a steady state economy, which I had never heard of before, and I'm impressed with the notion. I just wonder if you could briefly kind of describe that for our listeners.
Yeah, and we only have 3 minutes.
Well, I'll quickly say something. There is an organization, if you put the steady state economy into Google, I think you'll come up to their organization, which is called the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. And what they're saying is that we have to stop this idea of perpetual growth in a limited space. It just cannot happen. We have got to get back to an economy that it goes and functions in the earth and keeps the earth livable. And so this is a very important part of the book, and there's a section on it in the second part that Gary has covered. And go ahead. Otherwise, I've said my thing.
And I think it's important to add, too, that when we talk about a steady-state economy, which is sometimes called a no-growth economy, boy, does that sound like bad news. But actually, it's not, because we're talking about no growth in terms of materials and energy use that flow through an economy. It doesn't mean that we can't continue to develop. It doesn't mean that we can't continue to advance. It doesn't mean that the human story is coming to an end. It just means that we're going to learn to continue the human story without increases in terms of our materials use and energy use, which means more renewable energy, which means a circular economy so that all the materials we use get reused or recycled. It's actually a very hopeful sign, and it's also, finally, worth mentioning that while we're very accustomed to economies that grow every year, that was not a policy goal until after World War II. That before World War II, government policy was not about making economies grow. So we are challenged, I think, to go back to a model, but with many more people in the world and with a much more intensive materials and fuels intensive economy, we're challenged to go back to a model that worked very well and that can work for us, again, continuing to provide opportunity for people without such a huge imprint, a footprint on the planet.
Yeah, one important thing, and that's discussed in the book, and there's even a graph that shows it, that happiness has nothing, as long as you have enough food to eat and you're doing something that makes you happy and you have, you know, that you're happy doing and that you have connections, social connections. Your happiness does not increase at all by increasing with your wealth. And that's been, there are many books, actually there's a number of books on that and studies on it. And humanity has got to learn to understand this, especially the 1%ers.
Well, gentlemen, that's our musical cue you hear in the background to kind of end it here. We only have a minute to get off the air. So I want to thank you both, Gary Gardner from World Watch Institute and Peter Seidel, educator and co-author of There Is Still Time. I want to thank you for being on Unspun with us today. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Doug. This was great. And thank you, Dr. Craig.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
We thank you for the opportunity to talk about these things.
You're doing a great service, and we're proud to.
It's a great book.
Bring that to the listeners. So thank you once again. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Well, Dr. Doug Craig, thank you for co-hosting.
Thank you, Doug.
Yeah, and we'll do it again, I'm sure. Anyway, you've been listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. Our guests today have been Peter Seidel and Gary Gardner, co-authors of There's Still Time. We've been looking at when and how we need to proceed in a battle against climate change. Links and archives of our show will be at kkrn.org/shows/unspun. Until we talk again next week, tune in next week, Saturday, 9 a.m. for another dose of Unspun. Thanks for listening.